So commercial free till 10, is that what I'm hearing?
That's what the log looks like.
Commercial free until 10 o'clock. It is currently a quarter after. That gives us plenty of space to kind of stretch out and really explore what I want to talk about with you this hour, which is good because there's a lot to explore. There's a lot to say about it. Well, this is the question I have for you tonight. It's highly unlikely. I mean, it's possible in this age of internet broadcasting. We're, of course, available to stream at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. It's entirely possible that somebody listening tonight is actually going to cast a ballot in tomorrow's special election in Alabama, either for Roy Moore or Doug Jones or none of the above. But it's unlikely. I mean, most of us are not going to be casting a ballot in that election. Nonetheless, I feel as though it's an opportune moment for us to consider on this eve of that special election what we would do, how we would vote if we found ourselves in the position of having to make this decision. Because I think it's an instructive set of circumstances that Alabama voters find themselves in right now, and the Republican Party more broadly as a whole finds itself in right now. You know, this question of, do we have, for lack of a better term, a standard? Do we have a line past which, you know, a piece of conduct, a thing, a deed that somebody can engage in, something that somebody can do or be reasonably accused of having done, that would cause us to not vote for them, in spite of the fact that, quite rightly, that the analysis is correct when you say that their opponent, in this case, Democrat Doug Jones, would most likely vote the wrong way on virtually every public policy question. At what point does the weight of moral consideration, this thing we used to call principle, outweigh political consequences in the short term? That's the question that I have for you tonight. Put simply, would you vote for Roy Moore? I'll give you my answer, and we're going to explore some of the different aspects of what informs that decision as we move forward this evening. Closing Argument is the name of the program. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. 651-989-5855 to give us the answer to that question. Would you be voting for Roy Moore tonight? Would you be abstaining? Would you be voting for Doug Jones? And, you know, by the way, just to cut to the chase on that one, I would not be voting for Doug Jones, right? Like, Doug Jones, good Lord, no. But I do think it's a valid consideration whether or not you would vote for Roy Moore. And I do think that it's not necessarily, this is not a cut and dry thing. You know, I've been paying much more attention to the media today and a variety of different media sources than I typically do. I mean, there's a slight bit of irony in the fact that I come on here a couple hours every night and am a member of the media, and yet I'm not a big consumer of media. I'm just not. I don't listen to a lot of other programs. I don't spend a lot of time other than my show prep reading the news and what have you. Because I'm not particularly interested in other people's opinions for the most part. I feel as though it's easier for me to come up with my thing if I'm taking a fresh look at it instead of having it colored by what other people think. But today's been an exception to that. And the reason why is because every once in a while I find myself confronted with a conundrum or an issue that I genuinely am not sure where I fall down. And in those moments, it's helpful to turn to the analysis of others and to compare and contrast and see what points people are raising that perhaps you didn't think of, and to kind of weigh the things that are on your mind and weigh how your principles apply to the circumstances that you find yourself in order to try to inform your perspective and your decision-making process. And one of the things that I've heard people saying today as regards to Roy Moore is this notion that Doug Jones, you know, if you don't, the kind of binary thinking in terms of it's either Roy Moore, it's Doug Jones, and yeah, you got to go with one or the other. And Doug Jones is going to be worse on policy, which I don't think is disputable. I mean, that's pretty obvious from a conservative perspective. Doug Jones is going to be worse on policy. Therefore, you must vote for Roy Moore. Now, it occurs to me that this is a compelling argument. It is. It's so compelling that it has informed my own personal voting behavior and decision-making process in these circumstances for the vast majority of my adult life. There isn't a single, well, there's precisely two, I'll amend my statement, precisely two elections in which I have cast my vote for someone other than the Republican. The first election I ever participated in, I think it was 1998, when I was first eligible, I voted for Jesse Ventura because, frankly, I was young and dumb. I voted for Jesse Ventura. And this most recent election, 2016, I did not vote for Donald Trump. Those are the two instances in which I did not vote for the Republican. In every other case, I have voted party ticket, Republican. Now, that's not because I have found myself in total agreement or even enthusiastic support of every single Republican who's ever been on the ballot. That has almost never, in fact, that has never been the consideration. That's never been the case that I've been in 100% agreement with the person who I'm voting for. And very few people who I voted for, I've been enthusiastic about, right? There's always some amount of compromise that you engage in when you make the decision to cast your ballot for someone. But there's a difference. There is a line in my mind. There's a difference between the type of compromise that you typically make when you engage in the decision to vote for one candidate or the other, and the type of scenario that we found ourselves in my opinion, with Donald Trump, and the type of situation that we find ourselves in tomorrow, if you happen to live in Alabama, with Roy Moore. And the difference is this, broadly speaking. The kind of compromise that you have to make typically when you go into the voting booth is one of policy, right? It's, I don't agree with this person's position on, let's say, the war or foreign policy or the drug war or, you know, whatever the case may be. Immigration is a big one, right? Like, I don't agree 100% with their approach on this issue, but they're the nominee. They're not the Democrat. They're going to vote better, you know, 80% of the time than the alternative will. Overall, the calculation is such that it makes sense to make this compromise and vote for this person in order to get the best possible outcome. Now, that's the type of compromise that you find yourself in most of the time. What I find different in this case with Roy Moore, and we're going to presume for the moment, what we're going to get into, you know, later on here, an analysis of the evidence against him in terms of these accusations that have been raised. But for the time being, let's just accept for the sake of argument that he did these things, right? In the event that this is who he is and these are the things that he has done, that becomes an issue of character. It becomes an issue of fitness, like fitness for the office. What do we mean when we talk about somebody being fit for an office? Yeah, what do we mean when we talk about somebody being fit for a job or fit for our any sort of relationship, fit for our friendship, right? Fit for employment in our company or whatever the case may be. It's a holistic, it's a comprehensive analysis of the person. You know, are they the type of person who we want serving in that role? And, you know, here too, we end up making compromises, right? Like nobody's perfect. This is something that you're gonna hear said tonight in at least one of the clips that we're gonna play for you here momentarily. Nobody's perfect. People sin. People have vices. You know, people swear. They drink. You know, they have picadillos that they engage in. Right? Nobody's perfect. Right? That's true. But is there properly is a standard at some point? Right? Like if somebody went out, you know, Trump joked last year during the election that he could go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody in the head and people would still vote for him, right? Is that true or not? Like, is murder the line? is going out and, you know, lining people up and just executing them. Is that the point at which we're going to say, you know what? I don't want that person to be elected. I don't want that person to be a standard bearer in my political party. That person's not getting my vote, regardless of the fact that they probably vote the way I want on taxes, right? Like, is there a threshold past which we're not willing to make the compromise for short-term political gain? And that's kind of the deciding line for me, is that elections are always, always, always short to midterm consequence. We make them out to be these grandiose events that are going to determine the course of human destiny for all time. This is the most important election that we've ever had. You know, every election is the most important election. It's the most important election we've ever had. What happens tomorrow is going to determine the course of human destiny and civilization itself until the sun burns out, right? And the universe collapses in on itself. It's that important. But it's not that important. It is important. It's certainly important, but it's not that important. There, you know, it's just like driving your car down the highway, right? You make these small corrections, right, as you're driving along, as you're steering. But in the long term, you have to be concerned about your overall destination. Are you on course to where it is that you want to go? And the problem with having no limitation upon your willingness to compromise on those long-term goals in order to meet short-term expediency is that you're never going to get to where you want to go. You're never going to get to where you want to go. That's the context, or at least the introduction, I guess, that I want to lay out here for you as we consider a focus group put together by Frank Lutz. Now, this was something that was produced by Vice News, much to my surprise. I didn't realize Frank Lutz was in the Vice News business nowadays. But it's been much bantied about on social media. It's been played on the different mainstream media sources. I've heard people discussing it today. And I just found it fascinating. The whole thing is about a little over 7 minutes. We're not going to play the whole thing for you. We got snippets. And I watched this just mouth agape in awe of what I was hearing. What it is it's Alabama voters who are, I don't know what the qualification was to be as part of this focus group. I'm guessing it was Republicans that they're polling, trying to determine where they stand on Roy Moore. And what gets me is that I don't understand what the goal is here. Like, what is that long-term? What is the destination? What is it that we're trying to get to? And as we get into these snippets, hopefully I'll be able to make it clear for you the source of my confusion. And maybe you can make it clear to me how I'm wrong and how I need to get my head straight. 651-989-5855. Let's start with this first clip, clip one from the Frank Lutz focus group.
Are you all Christians here?
Yes.
Is Roy Moore a good Christian?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely?
Yes.
Without any doubt whatsoever.
Let me ask you this.
Nobody's perfect. Please explain, nobody's perfect when you look at the things that he has been accused of.
Is not found guilty.
I want to know.
Just because I don't go to church every time the doors are open doesn't mean I don't believe. And God doesn't expect us to be perfect, but he does expect us to try and repent of our sins. Yeah.
He's not my choice. I'm not voting for him because I like him. I'm voting for him because I don't want Doug Jones. But Roy Moore is entitled to the presumption of innocence in the law and in the Bible, just like anybody else should be. There are only accusations. There have been no charges filed. All you have is a group of women that have come forward said...
How many?
Seven.
More.
No, there's really three.
Higher. How many women have to come forward before you say, wait a minute, where there's smoke, there's fire?
It's a matter of legitimacy, not just how many.
Exactly.
How many are actually not being paid or being coerced to do this?
How many of them do you think are being paid?
All of them?
All
of them.
By show of hands, how many of you think all the women are being paid?
They all raise their
hands. Seriously.
To me, there are only two women that maybe have a smoking gun, but, you know, the women's reputations were questionable at the time.
Is this how you want to be treated as a woman if something were to happen to you? Do you want to be dismissed that way?
Better have proof.
You know, it doesn't sound like it went beyond there were still clothes on. It doesn't sound like it went beyond anything, and that as soon as the girl said she wasn't comfortable, he took her home.
I guess my question is, you blame her. She's 14.
I'm not blaming her. I'm blaming both of them. So I didn't say that I thought he was without sin. It's possible he did it, but it's possible that he could be forgiven for... I don't think he raped her.
Let's be real. It was a different world. 40 years ago in Alabama, people could get married at 13 and 14 years old. My grandmother at 13 was married at 15, had two children and a husband and a job. If Roy Moore was guilty, if he was at the mall hitting on this 14-year-old, 40 years ago in Alabama, there's a lot of mamas and daddies that'd be thrilled that their 14-year-old was getting hit on by a district attorney.
I dated an don't older man believe who's 16. That. Let's pause so that for a second. I don't believe that. I do not believe. Now, look, you can make the case that there was a cultural difference 40 years ago, and we've had callers into the program. I think Patty's called in and made this case that, and by her own confession, I'm not revealing anything. She hasn't revealed herself on the air. 70 years old, right? Back in the day, she says this was true, that people got married young. I don't dispute that people got married young. And I don't dispute the notion that perhaps the parents of a young daughter in that culture might be excited that somebody of the stature of a district attorney is interested in courting their daughter in order to get married as the goal. But you cannot tell me that there is a father anywhere on this planet who would be excited about a 30-something-year-old man fondling his 14-year-old daughter. That is not true. It is absurd to think that somebody would be, what did this guy say, tickled pink, right? Like, they'd be excited about it? No, they would not be excited about it. And there's a couple things here that stand out to me about the things that are being said in this focus group. First of all, there's an inconsistent rationale taking place here. And people seem to oscillate between two fundamentally unreconcilable rationales in defense of Roy Moore. The first is he's not guilty, right? Like the accusations are false. That's on one side of the spectrum. And then people will oscillate from that over to, but if he is, it's okay. Because that was the culture, and it's the 14-year-old's fault for being a hussy, I guess. I don't know what their argument is. It doesn't make any sense to me. But it's the swinging back and forth between he's not guilty, but if he is, then I'm okay with it. Those two things are inconsistent. If he's not guilty, then there is no reason for you to then talk about how if he is, it's okay. And if it's okay for him to have done the things that he's been accused of doing, then there's no reason to fret about whether or not he actually did them. And what this indicates to me is that there's a kind of desperation to run cover for Roy Moore that is not rooted in any sort of consistent intellectual analysis, and that is instead just what branch can we grasp at as we're on our way down? What branch can we grasp at in order to try to rationalize our continuing support for this guy? Either you think what he's been accused of is okay, or you don't. And if you think it's okay, then you don't need to argue to me about how he didn't do it. And if you don't think he did it, then you don't need to argue to me that it's okay if he did. Like, pick one, right? That's one of the things that stands out to me here. The other is the double standard in judgment for determining who's lying. Right. Like, on the one hand, you've got people in this focus group saying, we don't believe that Roy Moore did these things because it has not been established beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law. Right. It hasn't been notarized that he, in fact, did these things. So we don't believe that those accusations. But we are willing to believe Nine women were paid or coerced to invent stories about him. Now, where are you getting that from? Like, where's the proof of that? If by your own standard, you've established that in order for an accusation to be true, it has to be ironclad in a court of law, proven beyond a reasonable doubt, doesn't that standard apply to the accusation you're making against his accusers as much as it does against Roy Moore? Like, your basis for dismissing the accusers is that you believe an accusation about them, that they were paid, that they were coerced, for which there is no evidence whatsoever. None. Zero. So that's inconsistent. But the thing that gets me most of all about what I'm hearing here from this group is the notion of, you know, they keep talking about nobody's perfect and people should have second chances and people should be forgiven and what have you. And they make this kind of false appeal in my mind to a sort of Christian morality. Here's the thing about forgiveness. Forgiveness is a very real and necessary aspect of the Christian life specifically. And it's essential for all human life, generally. Grace is something that we must all display, because otherwise we're going to live our lives in a state of vindictiveness that is not sustainable. You know, that's where the left lives, by the way, just as an aside. The left lives in this perpetual state of vindictiveness where they are constantly focused on how they've been victimized and how justice must be served and how they need to get revenge for the wrongs that they feel have been done to them, right? That's what your life looks like when you do not know or express grace. So grace is very important. Forgiveness is very important. That said, forgiveness has a couple of prerequisites. Prerequisite number one to be forgiven, confession. Confession. You have to actually acknowledge, yes, I did this thing. I did it. I know it's wrong. I own up to it. That's prerequisite number one before you can be forgiven. Prerequisite number two, repentance. Turning from that which you have done. Turning away from it. Removing yourself from it, setting yourself aside, sanctifying yourself, and in that sense, moving closer to holiness. That is the process, and it's an order of operation. Confession, repentance, forgiveness. Confession, repentance, forgiveness. That's the order in which it happens. You cannot skip straight to forgiveness without there first having been a confession and then a repentance. And that's what people are trying to do on behalf of Roy Moore right now. They're trying to skip straight to, well, we just forgive him. For the thing that we don't believe he actually did, by the way, right? We don't believe he did it, but we forgive him if he did. This is a stretch of logic that I really can't grasp. I can't get my mind around it, how people are able and willing to engage in this sort of rationalization. But I do know why they're willing to do it. I do know why. As we continue with, I don't know if you can continue Reddit clip 3 or if it was paused from where we left off.
We can continue at this clip.
All right, let's do it.
Are you all Christians?
Guess not.
All right. Well, at any rate, I'll just describe what it is for you. All right. So their rationale after all of this for why, you know, because basically they're like, Frank, one of the guys is like, Frank, speaking to Lutz, you're wondering why it is that we're here, why it is that we're willing to support Roy Moore. Let me tell you, it's because he's the conservative. He's the conservative in this race. He's going to vote for conservative policy. And then one of the women goes on to say, policy is everything. That's what she says verbatim. Policy is everything.
Oh, you want clip 3 here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, Frank, what you're wanting to know is we got a bunch of conservatives here, and you want to know why we're going to vote for Roy Moore. My wife went to high school with Roy. She said in high school, Roy was a hard worker, an American success story, if you will. He always aimed for higher things. However, neither she nor I have ever voted for Roy up until now. And we intend to vote for Roy because of the opponent that's running. Right now, as far as I'm concerned, we've probably got two miserable candidates. In my opinion, we ought to go with a conservative. We ought to go with somebody that we know is going to vote conservative. And that's what I'm looking for.
Roy Moore is not a miserable man. This man has more integrity than you can find in the entire Congress right now. Don't fall for the George Soros assassination plan. The truth will come out. These women are all going to be proven, just like the 16 that went against President Trump just right before the election.
What about the women who went against Bill Clinton?
The accusers of Clinton, everybody knows he's a womanizer.
Well, people think the same thing about Roy Moore.
With Bill Clinton, they went to the courthouse and they filed papers. They didn't wait 40 years to do it. That's a huge difference than just going to the media only 6 weeks before an election.
So I got a question for you. We recruited, there are about 60
people. All right, you can go ahead and pause it here. I realize now that I edited this incorrectly. But regardless, you get the point there in terms of what the guy's going for. And then there's another clip, we won't even play it, where the gal says, as I noted, policy is everything. And so the notion is, he's the conservative, he's not Doug Jones, policy is everything. Now, I refer you back to what I said earlier. This is a style of argument that has merit. And that I believe every single time you walk into the voting booth, to one degree or another, you yield to this argument. You're not necessarily voting for every single thing that the person has said, done, and represents, and who they are as a person, everything they've ever done in their personal lives. Like, that's not what you're doing. You're not going to the voting booth to affirm the human being known as Roy Moore or Doug Jones or Donald Trump or whoever, right? What you're doing is you're making a calculation, and there is a degree of compromise in it, saying this is the choice of the two choices that are going to win. One of these are going to win. Of the two, this is the one that I believe is going to lead to a better outcome for me and my family and my nation, right? There's truth to that. But there's a point past which, to my mind, there's a diminishing return. There's a point past which the cost of that compromise is too high. And I'm not quite sure. I mean, if you just don't inherently understand what I mean when I say that, like if you can't think of that line past which you would not be willing to cast your vote for somebody, I'm not sure what I can say that could get you there. But let me try this. Let me just ask the question, and you can tell me, 651-989-5855. If policy is everything, as one of the gals in this focus group said, why? Why is it everything? Why does policy matter? Why are people going to go to their voting booth, their polling place tomorrow to cast a vote one way or the other in this special election? What is the point? What is it that we are trying to accomplish? And, you know, I'm not asking the question facetiously. I genuinely want to hear your answer. And, you know, as food for thought, let me give you mine. I want a world in which righteousness is rewarded and injustice is punished. I want a world where the condition of liberty is jealously defended. It's established and jealously defended, where people's individual rights to pursue their own values, utilizing their own judgment in full ownership of their lives, is held sacred and is protected by every apparatus of the law. That's what I want. Now, policy is the way to get there, right? Like, at some point, we need the actual structural formation, the institutions in place to do that. We need the laws on the books. We need to pass bills. We need to have the constitutional protections established, understood, and enforced, and what have you, in order to actually manifest that, right? So policy is everything in that sense. But if we get to a point past which we no longer really understand or care about why any of that stuff is important, then it loses its importance. It loses its importance. Being free, you know, and this is something that the founders understood. The founders understood this intimately. It was foremost on their minds. the notion that, particularly George Washington, he understood the danger of licentiousness, the danger of divorcing principle and morality and restraint, self-government, the self-government of the individual, the kind of self-government that keeps you from doing bad things individually, from divorcing that from your broader social pursuit of institutional liberty. Because if all you have, if all you have is legal freedom, right? The legal freedom to live your life the way you want to, and you don't have any actual sense of right and wrong, of what to do with this life you've been gifted, then you're not going to be able to keep the legal freedom. Because you're going to end up using it in such a way that it is of a detriment to the rest of society. And the only prescribed solution past that point is going to be greater control, greater empowerment of the state. And that's what we've seen happen. Example after example of it throughout history. Empowerment of the state resulting from a lack of restraint on the part of individuals who could not control themselves in a condition of relative liberty, and therefore lost it. Morality must come first. A sense of decency must come first. Character must come first. Character is everything, not policy. Character is everything. And that's what seems to have been completely lost, totally lost, in the current political moment. And I don't know when it happened. I don't know when it happened, but we're neck deep in it now at this point. We're at a point where the only consideration that seems to be taken seriously, that seems to be applauded, the only consideration is winning elections, beating the other guy, engaging in Twitter fights, these sort of symbolic victories for your team, tribalism, groupthink. These are the things that are important to us now. And if that's all it is, if all this is now at this point is Club Republican, Club Trump, Club Moore, if that's all it is this is our team, like being a Vikings fan, this is our team, and we're going to root for them and support them because they're our team and they're not the other guy, and the other guys suck because they're not our team. If that's all this is, then I don't see any point in it at all. None. Zero. Not even the short to midterm policy outcomes. One of the arguments that I've heard throughout the day today, as I've been listening to various media sources, is what's going to happen? What if Doug Jones wins and he's the deciding vote for more abortions, right? Like that's the thing people go to, which I think is pretty hilarious for a reason I'll get into here momentarily. What if he's the deciding vote on funding Planned Parenthood or whatever the case may be? That would just be horrible. Now, I'll grant you, of course, it's horrible that we have this epidemic of abortions taking place. Of course, it's beyond conscience. It's reprehensible that the federal government, that your tax dollars are coerced, are pulled from you at the point of a gun and handed to people who then go forth to engage in the systematic murder of babies. That's horrific. Of course it is. But I don't believe this concern that I've heard expressed today for the consequence of Doug Jones becoming the next senator from Alabama. I don't believe this gal in this focus group, this Frank Lutz focus group, who talks about policy being everything. When the hell did that happen? Where's this concern for policy that suddenly emerged? Let me remind you of something. Let's go back to, what's this? May of this year. This is Katie Pavlich, who you often hear on Justice and Drew in the mornings here on Twin Cities News Talk, writing at townhall.com. She writes, for years, Republicans have promised to defund abortion giant Planned Parenthood, which currently rakes in $500 million per year in taxpayer money. They've won elections on the issue after being backed by pro-life groups. Yet, with a new Republican majority in the House, Senate, and White House, Planned Parenthood is still getting taxpayer funding as part of a budget deal struck over the weekend. Again, this is back in May. President Trump said on the campaign trail he would be willing to keep Planned Parenthood funding so long as the organization stopped performing abortions. Since Inauguration Day, 81,000 abortions have been performed at Planned Parenthood clinics across the country. And again, this was back in May. Pro-life groups and conservatives with major political capital have taken notice. And then she goes on to cite a number of pro-life organizations that objected to the state of affairs back in May, with Republicans in control of literally everything. Over at the New York Times, in a more recent article, well, not that much more recent, actually, it was before this one, April of this year. Mr. Trump has shown ambivalence about Planned Parenthood, voicing support for its health-related services other than abortion, and his daughter Ivanka has urged him to tread carefully on the issue, concerned about the possible political repercussions of the Republican effort to defund the organization altogether. Now, if folks like this gal in the Frank Lutz focus group, and if folks like I've been hearing on the media all day today, were genuine, actually cared about policy and actually cared about the killing of babies and abortion and how many abortions we're going to have in the country from this day going forward. If they actually cared in the way that they're pretending to today because there's an election tomorrow, then this would not be the case. You wouldn't be, however many months we are now into, you know, what, 10 months into the administration of Donald Trump and Republicans in control of everything at the federal government, and still having Planned Parenthood funded with federal dollars. If it was really that important to you, and if policy really was everything, you'd be up in arms. You'd be in the streets. You'd be pulling your hair out. You'd be calling into talk radio programs every day about how horrible it is that we're still killing babies and still paying for it with taxpayer funding, right? But you're not. It's weird. It's weird. It's almost as if the policy isn't everything. It's almost as if policy doesn't actually matter at all. Which raises the question, what does? What does? And I don't have an answer to this question. I don't. At this point, I don't get it. I'm outside the kind of collective stream of consciousness where these things are apparently understood. What it is that's so important that we've got to support these guys no matter what they do, or no matter, you know, what positions they've taken, or what they say. Yeah. To what end? What is it that we're driving toward? What is so important? I don't know. Turning to Politico, analyzing the potential outcomes for tomorrow. Alabama's closely watched Senate special election could swing either way depending on who shows up to vote Tuesday. According to a new Monmouth University poll, which showed Democrat Doug Jones and Republican Roy Moore leading under different turnout models. If the turnout for Tuesday's special election looks like the 2014 midterm, Moore has a 48% to 44% lead over Jones. But if the election looks like turnout models based on the most high-profile statewide election of 2017 so far, last month's gubernatorial race in Virginia, the two men are tied at 46% of the vote. And if voter demographics resemble the 2016 presidential election, Jones has 48% of the vote to Moore's 45%, according to Monmouth. Patrick Murray, the director of the Monmouth University Polling Institute, said the major differences in the turnout model would be increased turnout in Birmingham, the state's largest city, and in 12 counties that are part of the state's Black Belt. The pollsters also allocated undecided and write-in voters to either Jones or Moore based on other questions about party preference, the impact of President Donald Trump's endorsement of Moore, and their opinions of the two candidates. So that's a little bit of polling that's taken place, as reported at Politico. Now, we move over to 538. They ask the question, what the hell is happening with these Alabama polls? Because the polls have been vastly different in terms of what they've been indicating. Somebody's going to be wrong in Alabama. We've already urged caution, this is 538 writing, when interpreting polls of Alabama's special election in the U.S. Senate, which will be held on Tuesday. Some of that is because of the media's unusual tendency to demand certainty from the polls when the polls can't provide that. And some of it is because of the circumstances of this particular race, a special election in mid-December in a state where Republicans almost never lose, but where the Republican candidate Roy Moore has been accused of sexual misconduct toward multiple underaged women. What we're seeing in Alabama goes beyond the usual warnings about minding the margin of error, however. There's a massive spread in results from poll to poll, with surveys on Monday morning showing everything from a 9-point lead for Moore to a 10-point advantage for Democrat Doug Jones. And they reflect two highly different approaches to polling. And then they go down to break out what those two approaches are. Basically, it's robocalls versus people directly calling you and asking you. What accounts for the differences between live caller and automated polls? There are several factors, all of which are potentially relevant to the race in Alabama. Automated polls are prohibited by law from calling voters on cell phones. Automated polls get lower response rates and therefore may have less representative samples. Automated polls may have fewer problems with shy voters who are reluctant to disclose their true voting intentions. Automated pollsters generally make more assumptions when modeling turnout, whereas traditional pollsters refer to let voters speak for themselves and take the results they obtain more at face value. Now, with that noted, guess which type of poll is predicting what? The automated polls are showing, let's see here, these polls have generally shown more ahead and closing strongly toward the end of the campaign, such as the Emerson College poll on Monday that showed Moore leading by 9 points. Recent automated polls from a variety of other sources have also shown Moore with lead. But when traditional live caller polls have weighed in, although these polls have been few and far between, they've shown a much different result. A poll released on Monday showed a tied race. Fox News's final poll of the race, also released on Monday, showed Jones ahead by 10 percentage points. So based upon where you put your faith here in the robocalls or the live polling, this could be very interesting tomorrow, which raises the question, what happens if Roy Moore loses? I don't know if this is a question that a lot of people have spent much time contemplating, because the assumption has been that he won't. The assumption has been he's going to win. What if he loses? What does that mean to you personally? And what does it mean for the Republican Party and for this moment in politics? Would this be a transitional moment to something different? Or is everybody just going to retreat to their corners and recalcify themselves in their previously established thought processes? 651-989-5855. Let's go to Jeremy in Anoka. Welcome to the program.
Hey, I kind of missed about the first half hour or so, but I guess I look at it like this. So let me start, but I'm not familiar with either of the candidates' policies or platforms other than one's a Republican, one's a Democrat.
Okay.
So I don't know any of the details. Okay, that said, if I supported Moore's policies a lot more than I supported Jones, then to me I would vote for Moore, and here's why. Because if it's just situation is there's just allegations at this point, then if they turn out to be true, my guess is that somehow he'll either resign or he'll be just pressured to leave. Mm-hmm. And if he isn't, I mean, I see that he's a pretty tenacious dude and he doesn't like to back down from allegations or whatever, you know, and all that. That's his reputation. If he isn't, then I made a mistake if he doesn't resign. But if the allegations turn out to be false, then I have a clear conscience because I voted for the person with the values that I believe in.
Right.
On the other hand, if I vote for somebody whose political values and beliefs and whatever I do not believe in,
right,
then I know that I won't feel good about my choice.
So right.
Do I go in not knowing I'm not going to feel good, or do I go in just wondering?
Right.
You know? And I feel like the situation will resolve itself if the allegations are true. Am I way off? Or
No, I listen, one thing I haven't said to this point, and I appreciate your call as always, Jeremy. One thing I haven't said to this point is that I don't have any judgment for people who are going to vote for Roy Moore on a basis similar to what Jeremy just described. Like, if you genuinely don't think he did what he's been accused of doing, then there's no issue, right? It's only if you have doubt or if you believe that there's a good chance that he, in fact, engaged in this behavior, that it becomes a matter of conscience. I don't believe that Roy Moore and Donald Trump are apples-to-apples comparisons, and maybe we'll get into that when we come back. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Listening to, you know, that last 45 minutes, you probably didn't catch on to the fact that I'm not interested in... My issue is not people who are going to vote for Roy Moore generally. Like, if you're going to vote for Roy Moore because you don't believe he did what he's accused of and you think he's better than Doug Jones, then more power to you. And I agree with you. Under those circumstances, that's the way to go. That's the way I would cast my vote. The difference between me and you in that circumstance is that I do tend to believe the accusations, and I think they're a problem. I think it's a problem to elect somebody to represent you who exhibits such reprehensible character in the event that these accusations are correct. The problem that I have is with folks like those who were interviewed by Frank Lutz in this focus group that we played clips from last hour, where they're not saying that, you know, we're going to vote for him because we don't believe this is true. They're intermingling that in with rationalizing, providing rationalization for what he's accused of doing, saying that, oh, that's just Alabama 40 years ago, right? Or, no, it's totally okay because, you know, we forgive and we forget. It's part of being a Christian is we forgive, even though the dude's not asking for forgiveness. He hasn't confessed and he hasn't repented. Like, that's what I have a problem with, is compromising your standards, your espoused standards, right? Like, if you just don't have any standards, if you woke up this morning with no standards, then fine, I guess I can't expect much of you. But when you go out there and you espouse to have certain standards, when you speak in the name of Christianity, or you speak in the name of conservatism, and you talk about how, you know, being conservative and conservative policies is so important and so grand and so wonderful, and then you're willing to overlook conduct which flies in the face of all of that, that's what I have a problem with. And that's what I have been speaking out against here for the past 45 minutes. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can catch up on past shows by just searching for Closing Argument right there in your iHeartRadio app. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. Let's go to Corey in Bloomington. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going, Walter?
You know. How you doing?
Doing good.
Good.
Still look for Roy Moore.
Yeah?
I'm thinking some of the stuff has already been proven false against him.
What's been proven false?
Oh, like the signature and the yearbook.
Yeah, to my knowledge, unless something's changed from the last time we read an article about it here on the program, the signature was real, but the reference to a date and location were forged by the accuser. So that's the scope of what has been proven false. So does that to your mind invalidate all 9 accounts from all 9 women?
Pretty much, yeah.
All right. I can't look. I can't argue with that. I appreciate your call, Corey. What can I say? I can't argue with that. And that's the kind of thing that was espoused in this focus group with Frank Lutz, where the guy was like, yeah, they're all lying. They're all being paid or coerced. How do you know that? What are you basing that on? Listen, I've gone on lengthy diatribes about how horrible the media is, how they're, and we're going to talk about it tonight if we get around to it here momentarily, all the mistakes they made over the weekend that just trip it over themselves to, you know, get out a damning story about Trump and not even bothering to adhere to any of their own editorial standards. The media is horrible. I get it. The left is full of liars and connivers and cheats and scum. I understand that. That's all true. But you can't just take that as a general axiom and use it as a rationalization to dismiss anything you don't like, right? Like, you can't just be like, well, I choose not to believe this accusation from these nine women, because generally speaking, the media is horrible, and genuinely speaking, the left is full of cheats and liars. That's not a logical argument. Let's go to Mike in St. Louis Park. How you doing?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Walter.
Yep.
I guess I really, as far as who gets that seat, really doesn't matter to me. I think at this point, Mr. Moore probably won't even be effective. But what troubles me is, has Mr. Moore been charged and has he been gone to court and convicted of these claims?
No.
And if we're just going to just preemptively jump to, okay, he's guilty, and throw him right under the bus, we're in deeper trouble than Mr. Moore.
Explain that to me, because I think I know what you're saying, but I'd like to hear you expound upon it.
Well, you know, it's like, do you still beat your wife? Now, can somebody come out and just make a claim and, okay, well, we just have to believe that. That's the public decides to side with that.
Mm-hmm.
But until it goes to court and evidence is produced, and you know, whether he has a jury or what kind of trial he has, mm-hmm. he's actually convicted of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I thought part of our republic was, you know, you are presumed innocent until you're proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how crazy things are these days. And the other thing that's curious about this is, where was everybody back when he was making his political crime? And where's the data? And you know, maybe there is data there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't hear any. It just seems really circumspect that now, when he can make a difference, and there's fear of that. And if you even look at the Mueller investigation and how they're banking on the Democrats getting control of the House, and you know, the Democrats play the long game. They're trying to see how they can upset Trump, and it's. When even with this Mueller investigation, all these little seeds that were planted prior to Trump winning the election. I mean, they're playing the long game. And again, going back to Mr. Moore, I'm troubled that all of this, it just seems like conveniently all of this comes forward and there's Gloria Allred and they've already got their playbook out and this is happening. And I would prefer to say that until he's convicted and proven guilty, there may be accusations. You can make claims, but where's your proof? Bring your case to court and prove it in the court of law.
So there's a couple things that I'll address here. The first being this proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard that's being applied. We require proof beyond a reasonable doubt when we are considering whether or not to deprive somebody of their liberty, when they are been arrested and they are facing criminal charges, and if they are found guilty, they are going to be put in a cage. That's when you have to have a burden of proof as high as proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That situation has not presented itself here. The question here is, are we, and by we, I mean individual voters, and for us, it's a rhetorical question, but for folks in Alabama, it's right in their face. They're doing it tomorrow. Are we going to lend our political support to this man? And to my mind, the burden of proof for that question is significantly lower, because the stakes to him are infinitesimal compared to if he was facing criminal charges. Like, if he doesn't win tomorrow, he goes on with his life as a free man, and the same as he did today and the day before. It doesn't affect him, right? So the question is, are we going to give our political support to a person who's been accused of these things? Now, in your analysis of whether or not you're going to do that, I think it's totally valid, just as Jeremy earlier called in and just as you're calling in now. It's totally valid to say, you know what, in my judgment, this has not been established. His guilt has not been established to a degree that I'm willing to allow it to affect my decision to vote for him or not for him. I don't have a problem with that at all. What I do have a problem with, and this is not you, Mike, which I appreciate, but I do have a problem with people who are like, if he did it, so what, right? Or if he did it, that's just the way things are, or like in this focus group, where the one guy is saying, oh yeah, back in the day, mom and dad would have been thrilled that their 13-year-old daughter was being hit on by a district attorney, because that's just the way things were. Get out of here. That is insane. Pick one. Pick your argument. If your argument is he didn't do it, fine. That's your subjective judgment versus my subjective judgment. But when your argument turns to, if he did do it, I'm okay with it, now we have a problem in my book.
The other thing I wish people would consider is his record and what is actually known about the man and what he's accomplished. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has some kind of value, too.
Well, and that goes to your other point regarding why didn't this come up, and this is that's been a common objection that's been raised throughout this entire episode, is why did this come up now? Why not, you know, sometime over the preceding 40 years? Why not during the rest of his political career? And I think the answer to that has been right out in front of us from the very beginning, which is that this story came from the Washington Times as a result of a reporter who was out there covering the campaign and tripped upon rumors and then followed up on them, found these women, and then convinced them to come forward with their stories. It wasn't that the women were sitting on it for an opportune political moment and then decided all at once that they were going to try to torpedo the guy. It's a story that emerged when it emerged, and it was something that was corroborated by the reputation. You know, you talk about the guy's record, talk about how he's known in the community. It was corroborated by people in the community who are like, yep, he's that kind of guy. We've always known that he's been, you know, trolling the malls and what have you for dates from young women. So to me, it's the when you take into consideration all of the evidence, anecdotal and compare it to the specifics of the accusations, there's enough of a doubt there that I would not be comfortable supporting the guy. But if your conclusion is, I don't think that threshold has been met, then I get why you would vote for him.
Well, here's one last point is, put this in the context of, why did Bill Clinton get a free pass, folks?
Yeah. Well, I mean, should he have? And if the answer is no, then we don't gain anything by giving more pass now. Like, this Me Too-ism, there are two different ways that Me Too-ism works, and I appreciate your call, Mike. I appreciate you sticking with me through this segment. There are two different ways to utilize this kind of Me Too-ism. One is when the other side does something that they've come after you for, and they're therefore being hypocritical. Like, that's a legitimate way to do it. The illegitimate way to do it is to say, those other guys got caught with their hand in the cookie jar, so you don't get to come after me for having my hand in that cookie jar. That's not how morality works. We're not racing towards the bottom by looking for the lowest common denominator of conduct, of standards here. And if that's the direction we're going to go, then I don't see the point of any of this. I don't see the point of voting. I don't see the point of participating. I don't see the point of activism at all. If we don't have a standard, an ideal that we're striving toward that requires us to ratchet up to it rather than continually compromise downward. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So kind of related to this topic of what voters are going to do in Alabama tomorrow, faced with the decision between Roy Moore and not Roy Moore, which is really kind of the decision, I guess. Roy Moore and Doug Jones. These binary choices, they didn't used to be this hard. This whole lesser of two evils argument used to be much more compelling than it has been in recent years. As a side note to all of this, it occurred to me today, and I suppose this isn't some big epiphany. It may be obvious to you when I say it, but I guess I had to come to the realization of my own. I realized today that I am not, most definitely not, a populist. I'm not. Now, I've contended that I have a problem with the national populism that has displaced conservatism within the Republican Party over the past couple of years. But I've always kind of maintained that the notion of trying to appeal to the people and go with the people and represent the people isn't inherently bad. It matters how you do it, right? And I realized today that that's not even true. That's not specific enough. That's not a specific enough distinction to mean anything. I'm at 180 degrees opposed to populism, and I'll tell you why. What populism is it's a inversion of polarity. It's reversing the poles in terms of the way governing ought to properly work and leadership ought to properly work. What populism says is that the quote-unquote leaders ought to take the temperature of the populace and then do what the populace wants. That they ought to be slaves of the popular whim. That's what populism is, fundamentally, at its root. Now, if that were true, if there was something inherently right and moral and good and righteous about populism, then we properly ought to be seeking pure democracy, right? I mean, why have checks and balances and three branches of government and a constitution and a bill of rights and limitations and what have you for on government? Why have all that if all that really matters is how the people generally feel and what the people generally want? What's wrong with a lynch mob? That's what the people want. Lynch the guy, right? They want it. Populism. No. That's not leadership. That is the opposite of leadership. That is the shepherd being led around by the sheep. We need the opposite in order to have liberty, in order to have Western civilization. We need leaders who are willing to establish, maintain, uphold, and strive toward a higher ideal, and to lead the populace, lead people to that. To say no to their whims and to point them in a better direction. That's what we need. Now, I'm not saying here, as a libertarian, I'm not saying here that we need a king, right, who's going to tell us what we're going to do. What I'm saying is that we need a Ronald Reagan, right? We need somebody who is going to inspire us to our better selves. That's what leadership is. That's what the great leaders in history, in our history, in Western civilization, the Winston Churchills, the Margaret Thatchers, the Ronald Reagans, you know, you go back further, the George Washingtons, the Thomas Jeffersons. That's the character that they had, the characteristic that they had, was an ability to, in spite of the populace, in spite of the whims of the people, were able to say, no, we are not going to succumb to our base nature. We are not going to compromise down to a lower standard for short-term political expediency. We are going to aim higher. We are going to take the path not taken. We're going to take the path that goes around the long way, up the steeper slope, over the craggy terrain, because it gets us to the better place. That's what we need. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. Let's go to Matt in Stillwater. Welcome to the program.
How you doing, Walter?
How you doing?
Great. Wow, that last segment there that you just really brought back. You know, Ronald Reagan was the first president that I voted for.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right. What you're saying about we need that kind of leadership again. I voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
and immediately wanted to go take a shower. But let me tell you, as soon as I realized that's how I felt, and I saw the first person that was a big Hillary supporter, and everything I've lived through with the Clintons,
Right.
We know what that is all about. Yeah. I knew what that was all about. There was no other choice.
Sure.
That's how I justify my decision to pull for Trump.
Sure.
The guy has made me cringe on more occasions than I care to, you know, admit with his tweets,
and
things that he says in speeches. But the bottom line is I voted for him because I thought economically he was going to put us on the right path. You know, the border thing was somewhat important, but not like a huge thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
But the military was being drained of its resources that I felt, you know, it wasn't, military was not being used the way it should have been used for the past 8 years. Trump has changed that. And I think we can see economically, whether it's just from him pumping things up and the regulations that he's overturned, this economy is on the cusp of taking off big time. And that is what I remember from Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
Was living through those 80s, the 90s, the early 90s, where there was still that benefit of the Reagan era. We're right there. Now, does that justify this whole Roy Moore thing? That was the original reason I called in, was to talk about Roy Moore.
Mm-hmm.
That whole thing, again, I agree totally with what your comments have been, that this guy is, you know, I mean, suspect for sure. But again, we're on the verge of a witch hunt here with everybody, not just Roy Moore, everybody.
I agree.
Everybody can come forward and make a comment about somebody, and that person could lose their livelihood over it.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I get it. This is disgusting. Whatever he's being accused of here is disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
But where do we draw the line on accusations and evidence? You've got to have something to put forth before you take somebody down as a career politician, a businessman, whatever. There's got to be some evidence.
Yeah, I agree with you, Matt, and I think that the specifics, for me, in my subjective judgment, and that's all we have, is our own judgment, that threshold has been reached. Now, I'm not faced with the decision to vote for Roy Moore, and neither are you, but if I was, I could tell you, I don't think I'd be pulling that lever for him. And it's because, in my judgment, enough evidence, and admitting to, and accepting everything that you've said about the witch hunt and the fact that we need to have some sort of standard for whether or not we accept accusations, what have you, that's all true. The specifics of what have been brought to bear against Roy Moore in terms of accusations and the supporting evidence anecdotally that has come to light and been reported on is sufficient for me to establish that I should not be supporting the guy, right? Now, to your larger point of what's the world going to look like if Republicans lose their majority in the Senate? What's the world going to look like? What would the world look like if Hillary Clinton had won last year, right? It would be and the answer is horrific, right? Like bad. Yep. There's just no doubt. Now, but let me flip the other side of that coin for you. What happens if the rest of society, American society, reaches a point where they're sick and tired of what they've seen from Republicans this go round, and we end up with yet another situation like we had a few years back where we just have like a decade of Republicans losing? What's that going to look like?
Yeah, I agree. That's a scary thought, but at the same time, go back to the camp, the whole election. I mean, I was supporting Ben Carson.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, he was a long shot at best, but I somehow brought myself to switch, and I think mainly because the only reason I did flip for Trump was because Carson himself was the first one to back the man.
Sure, sure.
And I honestly don't think I could have ever gotten to that point. Trump, sure. There was nothing about him that appealed to me. Outside of the economic stuff, I knew he was going to follow a Reaganomics kind of push, and that I liked. I think that's where we needed to be.
Well, I appreciate your call tonight, Matt, and your candid insight. We do have to go to a break, but be sure to call back again. All right. 651-989-5855. We will continue on with some of the other news of the day, of which there's been quite a bit. When we return, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. By the way, I realized that at no point in the preceding discussion have I disclosed this little tidbit. Were it not for the accusations, and were it not for my judgment that the accusations against Roy Moore are credible, then he would be somebody that I would be enthusiastic about supporting. Based upon his background, his record, what he's done in the past, the stances he's taken, the stands he's made against federal authority in favor of religious freedom and conservative values. So this, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who are intermingling the case for taking the accusation seriously with a breakdown of what a horrible person Roy Moore is because of the things he wants to do in policy. You see this case being made. Apparently David French wrote something to this effect. I don't know if it was today, but it was certainly recently. Of course, you see it on the left, naturally, right? They talk about how he's anti-gay and, you know, he wants to take us back to the times of slavery and all this nonsense. Yeah, one of the worst, I saw a clip from, Morning Joe? It's been showing up more and more on my YouTube feed because I think the algorithm is starting to catch on that I find perverse enjoyment in watching these little clips from shows of this nature, watching the left squirm. But, you know, they tried to make the case that because Roy Moore had a quote from Hitler, that they tried to imply that makes him a Nazi, that he agrees with Hitler because he quoted the guy. You know what the quote was from Hitler? The quote was, if you tell a lie often enough, people will accept it as the truth. That's the paraphrase. That's the quote. I've quoted that. Maybe you have quoted that. We've heard that. Are we to believe that Roy Moore is a Nazi because he quoted in that context? Clearly, it's a warning, right? It's, hey, this is what this horrible person believed, and there's merit to it. Lies repeated frequently can end up being perceived as the truth. So, you know, the efforts to which some people are going to try to intermingle and conflate these two concerns of the guy's policy with the accusations, I think, is a disservice to the accusations. It's a politicization of something that should not be politicized. And that's unfortunate. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Brad Omland taking your calls at 651-989-5855. Let's go to Lou in Brooklyn Park. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Walter.
Yep.
Just a few headlines here. Just quickly, I'll mention them, and you can just say, yeah, I heard about that, or I didn't, or... Okay, here's number one. Marines land at Langley CIA headquarters in silent helicopters 3 weeks ago. Did you hear about that one?
No.
Okay. Did you hear about Mel Gibson, like, a week ago, commenting on the blood drinkers and the cannibals in Hollywood?
Nope.
And did you hear about the fires burning unusually hot? Did you see some of the pictures of the metal burning and stuff, the liquid the metal had turned into liquid and some of the things that were going on.
Where was that?
Out in California with these real
wildfires.
Yeah, did you see the damage to the houses and stuff? How they were just totally... It was like a nuclear blast had come in there, and everything was just gone.
I saw that there were fires. I didn't dig into it that deeply.
Okay.
What are you getting at?
Well, I'm just, we're talking about grabbing asses and everything, and, I mean, it's almost like we got a civil war going on or something, and then we got the distraction of,
I don't know that
someone else's butt or something like that or whatever. We got all this serious, or the Getty Museum underground. Have you heard about that one?
The Getty Museum?
The Getty Museum, the underground quarters, the city that was built in, it was right outside of L.A., sitting on top of a hill.
Uh-huh.
You ought to look into that stuff. Or did you hear about the black community that showed up in Washington after that Pizzagate deal and they were raising hell, which I was on their side about? But, that was a few months ago. That's the only one that wasn't recent. But
I'll tell you what, I'm easy enough to find on social media. Send me this stuff. I got 2 hours to fill every night. I'm more than happy to take a look at it. But no, to answer your question, Lou, I appreciate your call, by the way. I have not heard those various headlines, and some of them I heard a little bit about and didn't dig any further. I'm not sure what... I guess I gathered the point is there's other things that I'm supposed to be talking about. This is something that I hear every once in a while, and everybody who's in media hears this, right? Why are you talking about fill-in-the-blank X issue of the day when you could be talking about the atrocity of the Federal Reserve? And it's like, look, a couple of things. One, yeah, the Federal Reserve is bad, or fill in the blank, whatever the issue is. Yeah, that's bad, and yeah, we can and have talked about it. But it's possible to hold two concerns in your head at the same time, number one. And number two, I'm not going to talk about things that are not provoking my interest in the moment. And you're more than, feel totally free to judge me till the end of time for those things which provoke my attention. But, I don't know how to come on here and talk about things that I'm not immediately interested in. So that's kind of how this whole commentary thing works. Let's go to Kim. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you, Walter. Interesting show. Points to, and I've never listened before. I'm listening on my way home in the car.
Oh, well, fascinating. Glad you found us.
I do differ from you, though. First off, I should say, registered independent. First president I ever voted for was Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Sprinkled all over. I'm platform voter.
Mm-hmm.
Not a party
okay.
voter.
Fair enough.
But not a big... I would like more emphasis on the things forgotten, kind of like the last caller.
Okay.
I don't like... I'm all for, and it's about doggone time, let's criminalize predators. And I do believe Trump and... the guy in Alabama are one of them. I don't believe Al Franken was. He's guilty of groper and comedic humor and is a dignified guy to resign from his position, and I support that. And I think he'll do still great good in the private sector. But the trafficking of human beings has lost a highlight since Trump got in. And I want...
I agree with you. I agree with you 100% that the traffic of human beings is extraordinarily important. However, when can you point to in the past decade where the trafficking of human beings has been something that people have been focused on at any level, either in public policy or in the media? Like the election of Donald Trump, and I'm no Trump fan. I know this is your first time listening to the show tonight, but I'm probably the least Trump-friendly conservative talk radio host, certainly
yes,
in the metro. Certainly in the metro.
What triggered actually need to call in?
but the idea that his election triggered disinterest in human trafficking, I find a little
not triggered it. It's buried it though, because it's all the hype about his latest tweet and his latest this and his latest. I don't care about the tweet. I want to see him get something done while he's in office. I want to see him be effective. I don't want Reaganomics back. Mm-hmm. I was buying my first home in the 80s with those terribly high interest rates. Mm-hmm. And I've had a few Republican friends that, longtime Republican friends, were converted during that era, because then after he left office is when they saw being able to make more of a living. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of trickle-down theories, that where we differ. Mm-hmm. I like the globalization of Nixon, and that's why he was one of the first ones that I voted for, because I liked that he was seeing beyond our borders, where we needed to go. I thought he was, I like forward thinkers and people that think outside of themselves. And I don't think we have that in the president right now, but
I don't think we have it in many places.
This Me Too thing to put predators where they belong. I don't care what office they hold. I don't care what party they belong to. If you're a predator and you're knowing to going to repeat places like malls or wherever, and you don't take no for an answer or a slap back when you offend a child or a person, then you are a predator and you need to be criminalized and prosecuted as such.
All right. I appreciate your thoughts, Kim. Appreciate you calling in, and hope you'll continue to listen to the program, and maybe we can have some conversations later down the line. All right. 651-989-5855. Everything else that happened today in less than 10 minutes when we return. Closing argument, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Of course, the other big news today from Bloomberg, a Brooklyn man wearing a pipe bomb attached with Velcro and zip ties set off an explosive in the Times Square subway station Monday morning, injuring himself and three others, sending ambulances racing and commuters fleeing as Christmas shoppers poured into New York City. The 27-year-old suspect, Aikied Yula, wore the device that went off shortly after 7 a.m. in an attempted terror attack, Police Commissioner James O'Neill said at a news conference near the scene. Yula suffered serious burns, while other victims had minor injuries, he said. The suspect came to the U.S. from Bangladesh in 2011 on a family immigrant visa and as a legal resident, Department of Homeland Security spokesman Tyler Q. Holton said on Twitter. Yula lives on Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn with his mother and a sister. According to a police official knowledgeable about the investigation, he worked as a driver but has a background as an electrician. Yula told police he's a follower of ISIS, but investigators believe he's a solo actor who planned the act after reading one of the terror group's publications on the internet. I don't see how those two things are mutually exclusive. Like, if you say, I'm a follower of ISIS, and you got your bomb-making plan from ISIS materials on the internet, I mean, that's technically accurate. You don't have to be a card-carrying ISIS person. So, I don't see the distinction there.
An NRA member would at least know how to fire a gun correctly. And I mean, when you commit a terrorist act and ISIS says, nah, that wasn't us.
Like, right.
You can probably believe it.
Is that what happened here? Did ISIS say, no, that wasn't us?
I don't know. But that's what it sounds like you're saying.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that's happened. I mean, ISIS is usually pretty anxious. They even take credit for things that they didn't do, you know, so be that as it may. Well, the interesting thing here is that the guy was here legally, which kind of undermines the whole, you know, this that's of the many points that are raised by the if you want to characterize it as open borders side of the immigration debate, one of the more legitimate points that they raise is this notion that terrorism by illegal immigrants isn't a thing. As on the whole, like, most of the terrorist attacks that have taken place by people who had legal status to be here in the country.
Even the guy who drove the van down Central Park, or was here illegally.
The guy he was from here
Uzbekistan.
Legally?
Yeah, he was here legally. The guy from Uzbekistan.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, now, that's not to say that doesn't, because the counter argument is, okay, then we need to look at who gets here legally. Like, we need to tighten that down, which is a totally legitimate consideration. But the thing is I don't know, like, what's the nexus of policies that's going to prevent something like this from ever happening? I don't know the answer to that question.
I think that's impossible.
And I suspect that the effort to try to achieve such an unattainable goal leads us to a place of diminished liberty that becomes less desirable than the possibility that you might find yourself caught up in something like this. All right, so the media is having a bad week, to say the least. From the Daily Wire, this past week was disastrous for the press. A slew of fake stories rained down, pushed by anxious anchormen placed in powerful posts. And we want to note before we go on that all of this happened in a single week. On Friday, December 1st, ABC News reported that former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was ready to testify that Donald Trump, while still a candidate for president, directed him to contact Russian officials. That would have been a big no-no, but it wasn't true. The network waited most of the day to issue a clarification that said President-elect Trump directed Flynn to reach out to the Russians, a huge difference as incoming administrations routinely begin communications with foreign leaders. The stock market plunged on the news, dropping 350 points. A day later, the reporter responsible for the story, Brian Ross, was suspended for 4 weeks, and the network said he would no longer cover President Trump. On Monday, CNN's Jim Acosta, who was trying to become a star by berating Trump at every turn, said when journalists are attacked, journalists have to resist. That rings of the Democratic Party's mantra to resist, and we'll note that that's not at all what good journalism is about. To Acosta and others who regularly cover the White House, this is what journalism is today. On Tuesday, Reuters and Bloomberg, two left-leaning wire services that have bashed Trump from the outset, reported that special counsel Robert Mueller had subpoenaed Deutsche Bank for records on Trump and his family members, but that wasn't true either. The Wall Street Journal later reported that the subpoenas actually didn't target Trump and his family, but rather people or entities close to Mr. Trump. Big difference, or as Trump would say, huge. Then on Friday, CNN reported that Donald Trump Jr. and special or senior Trump officials, possibly even Trump himself, received an email in September directing them to what CNN said were unreleased WikiLeaks documents that may have been hacked from the Democratic National Committee. That, too, would have been a giant story, but it was all wrong again. This is why people are willing to swallow the character deficiencies. Because the media is so god-awful, and the left has no standards, that we've decided that we're just going to jump in that boat, too, and throw our standards out with the bathwater. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.